Under past rules, hatcheries, as well as shore-based and large floating processors, were able to sell salmon roe and grind up and dump the rest of the fish. In recent years, some fishers began marketing and selling their own fish. No problem. But 2 years ago, with prices in the gutter, a group of fishers in southeast Alaska became certified by DEC as catcher processors. Like shore-based and large floating processors, these fishers began to strip the roe and throw away the meat. There were only 30 or so catcher processors, but the numbers were growing fast. Fish and Game checked it out, and last year, the State Department of Law concluded that the practice of dumping wasn't allowed for anyone. Now Fish and Game is revising its regulations with an exemption for hatcheries available for the next 2 years. Fish and Game's Jaron Bruce.
We recognize some unique circumstances that the hatcheries are operating in, specifically that they are nonprofit corporations that are providing general benefits to Alaskans in the commercial fisheries and the recreational fisheries, and that they're restricted in their harvest opportunities to these terminal areas where they must deal with fish that are necessarily of lower quality than what would be harvested farther out in the migratory corridors.
Hatcheries rely on cost recovery, catching and selling a portion of the fish they produce as their only revenue source. Valdez Fisheries Development Association Director Dave Cobb says the new restrictions will make it tougher to break even.
In order to get an exemption this year, you have to do X number of things, and you have to account for all your fish. You have to try to give your carcasses away. You have to try to sell them. You have to provide them to the public. You have to ice them in totes, numerous things like that.
VFDA is working to get that authorization, and Cobb is worried about what will happen after the exemption sunsets. Prince William Sound Aquaculture Corporation, or PISWAC, is a larger regional organization with 5 hatcheries and a budget of over $8 million. PISWAC's Howard Farron says that, based on PISWAC's forecasts of the 1996 season's prices and returns, PISWAC doesn't plan to apply for an exemption, but certain conditions could require it.
We, the administration, management of the corporation, and the board, again, find it hard to rationalize that we're in the business of producing something that's wasted. It's not what we're here to do. And if markets haven't developed to the point to utilize the resource that we now have in place, we can look at some options. Again, food banks is one possibility, although it's difficult because there's always cost attached. But there are other options such as fish meal, and there are markets for meal.
Farron says PISWAC is seriously looking at fish meal as an option this season, and other potential markets include fertilizer, dog food, and pet food snacks. Farron says PISWAC supports the new regulations and supports the sunset clause.
By providing a sunset clause, the industry can install the necessary capital infrastructure to confront that situation, so that even with broodstock carcasses and perhaps fish that don't have markets late in the run, as we've seen happen, you will still find some utilization for it.
Both VFDA and PISWAC sell small amounts of the more valuable roe, but most of the eggs they collect are the broodstock for next year's run. Even under the new regulations, the hatcheries will be allowed to dispose of the carcasses of fish used only for broodstock. In Valdez, I'm Shauna Simmons.
Three, two, one. Struggle is inherent. Countries battle over borders, labor and management over wages and benefits. From divorcing couples and disgruntled neighbors, subsistence to abortion, individuals to whole cultures, there's always some kind of conflict going on, and imperfect tools for resolving it. At the greatest extreme, both individuals and cultures resort to violence. At the other end, giving up. In the middle are the ballot box, the boycott, courts, and a range of other options human beings have devised to settle problems. Colorado-based mediator Bernie Meyer says not every mechanism fits every need, and sometimes even a good tool can make things worse.
In court, in order to be effective, you don't acknowledge the reasonableness of the other side's case and ask them to acknowledge the reasonable of your case and then try to work it out, you got to make the other side's case look absolutely horrible and the people absurd for even raising it.
And when court's out, the litigants may still have to make peace. There are less adversarial alternatives. If the parties have hit a rough patch but are generally in agreement, facilitation may be enough to settle the differences, as long as the issues aren't too controversial and there's no real friction over values. When there is, Chris Smith, Assistant Director of Wildlife Conservation for Fish and Game, says people may need more structure.
As you move more toward areas where there is conflict or where there's confrontation or competition between interests, that's where mediation can play a valuable role in helping the parties to understand and recognize others' values and accommodate those, seek solutions that are in everybody's best interest.
In mediation, both sides retain control. The mediator listens and helps people think creatively. Colorado mediator Judy Modest Dixon.
So I think the mediator's role is to offer a process. It's to keep a negotiation focused. It is to keep people thinking progressively about how they can resolve it. And it's certainly to be neutral. That is, the mediator doesn't have an investment in one particular outcome or another, or in helping one particular party or another, but really has an investment in helping both of the parties, or all of the parties as the case may be, to come up with something that works for them.
People don't come into a mediation ready to make agreements. They're generally focused on their own issues, wanting to win. They don't intend to compromise or to give up. Smith believes the process helps them push to a more demanding level of thinking.
As you get parties working together and coming to understand and appreciate others' values, others' interests, and you look beyond the positions, you will frequently find that there are ways to accommodate everyone's interests that were not envisioned or even imaginable when the parties first came to the table.
Fairbanks mediator Susan Todd is an assistant professor of resource planning at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. She's mediated land disputes, wolf and caribou issues, and teaches college students how to learn mediation. She says it's hard work for the mediator and for the team.
It's not really glorious work. It's long hours in meetings and on the telephone and mostly voluntary. Hours and hours of people volunteering their time. So somebody who really wants lots of glory is just not the place for them. And they need to be, you know, good team members, cooperate, work with others.
Mediation is an old tool that's found new usefulness in the past few decades. Meyer says it has a great range of possibilities.
Not just for divorce issues in families, but for helping families with runaway kids, for helping deal with care of the elderly issues. In helping deal with issues of harassment in the workplace in a productive way, looking at how to handle community decisions where there are very many different points of view within the same community.
Modest Dixon looks at it to help families in estate planning, and as healthcare becomes more complex and more expensive, with more options and more conflict, to keep lawsuits to a minimum.
There are doctors and there are lawyers and there are the healthcare institution administrators and patient rep staff and private contractors and patients and families themselves who are really looking at new ways to solve problems.
On the personal level or the global one, mediation takes some courage, not the kind of courage to speak your mind and stick to your guns, but Meyer says one that's a step more demanding.
It takes a great deal of courage after you've advocated for a cause or for a position to say, I also understand there's another side and I need to reach out to my opponents or my people in opposition to me and try to find common ground. And I think it takes an enormous amount of courage. And we just have to look at what happened to Rabin and Sadat to say, this is and think of the courage I think it took for Nelson Mandela to reach out to people who'd imprisoned him for 25 years and say, I see a humanity and I want to work with you because only together can we move the society forward. I think that's very profound human courage.
In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes. Two, three, two, one. Not long ago, a state biologist was asked to develop a resource plan. He got the job done, submitted it to his agency, and began to find death threats in his mailbox. Then voices on the phone that said, "We know where your children are. We know the roads they take home from school." This biologist was just doing his job, but he ran afoul of some tough-minded, alienated public opinion. It was an extreme evidence of just how heated issues can be. Bernie Meyer, a Colorado-based mediator, says people can get locked in tunnel vision.
It's very hard for people who are competing for limited resources to say, look, there's a legitimate problem here. Everybody wants these limited resources, and we just have to come up with a reasonable way of dividing it up. More likely is people start personalizing the issues and blaming other people for wanting something.
If opponents remain competitive and separated, there's little chance of resolution. But if they get into a room with someone who can make them talk, they may get somewhere. Susan Todd is an assistant professor of natural resource planning at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. She mediated the 40-mile caribou herd planning group.
In 1992, the proposal was for to increase the 40-mile caribou herd, they would shoot 450 wolves. Last year, they came up with a way to increase the caribou herd significantly, they think, by sterilizing 16 males. You shoot 450 or you sterilize 16. That's a pretty dramatic difference.
It took 3 years for the group to get there and a lot of hard work. Mediation, Todd says, is no picnic.
There's a lot of change expected in a short amount of time. You're forcing people to be creative, think in new ways of solutions they've never thought of before. Consider sterilization instead of helicopters. Well, we were laughed at by many people who, you know, you've got to be kidding. So it takes some courage. And there's going to be real strong emotions, long hours, people get tired, people get cross.
If their solution is going to survive, a planning group has to represent every significant point of view, and the mediator must come to the room knowing the laws and regulations, issues and interests from every perspective. Her job is the process.
Really, the mediator shouldn't care too much whether they strip mine the whole area, let's say, or they put it all into a park. That's not the real concern. The real concern is, I want something everybody can sign.
To get to a signature, every member has to be on an equal footing with the others. Chris Smith is Assistant Director of Wildlife Conservation for Fish and Game.
When you go into mediation, you do not give up any control. You may share responsibility with other parties, but if you're working toward a consensus agreement, then all it takes to prevent reaching consensus is for one party not to agree.
Team members usually come in skeptical, looking for the best deal, entrenched in their positions. The commitment they make, Smith says, must be to participate wholeheartedly.
The cost of a seat at the table is a willingness to negotiate in good faith and to stick with that process and not to pursue alternative avenues to resolve the issue as long as you're sitting at the table.
Each mediator is different. Between meetings, Todd's on the phone, pushing and debating positions, searching for common ground. She says she works the process hard, but always has faith.
You have to trust the process. You have to trust those people to be wise in a way, to look beyond themselves. Hopefully you've set the team up so that we will take into account environmental impacts, long-term economic impacts, social impacts, so that all those things are represented at the table. But then, if that team is well built like that, to consider all the options and all the possible impacts, then it's pretty safe, I think, to say, okay, if you guys sign off on it, it's probably a pretty good plan.
The 16 alpha wolves and their packs will live out their lives. With luck, they'll hold their territory against other wolves and continue to hunt caribou while they live, but they won't raise a new generation of pups. In time, the caribou herd will increase sufficiently to withstand future predation. At least, that's what the planning group hopes for. And Todd says other countries are watching to see if this more subtle method of predator control is successful. If it is, the mediated solution may be useful worldwide. If not, the 40-mile caribou herd planning group will sit down to talk again. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes. There was a time when the custody of children wasn't much of an issue. State child custody investigator Barry Levitt says just 100 years ago, one parent had absolute authority.
There was no question. Children belonged to their fathers. You know, they were property, and there were no questions. The answers were provided if there was whatever was called a custody dispute back then. Then it evolved into the tender years presumption. Mothers got children. I mean, that was just the way it was. Today, it's best interests of the children.
The evolution in custody may mean an ongoing shared responsibility for divorcing parents. But Levitt says a child's best interests can get lost in the crisis and in an overloaded court structure that wasn't built for this kind of decision-making.
The system was never designed to deal with child custody matters. Child custody matters are being fit into an overall system of problem resolution, which is still evolving. And I think that that's the pinch that people feel.
Attorney Skip Cook says parents have a huge responsibility at a very bad time to stay fully in a child's life while separating their own.
Because, as the judges keep telling parties, it's traumatic enough to have the divorce without, you know, the child feeling like they've lost a parent, or that they're being pressured by a parent, or that they have to make choices between parents.
Attorneys, judges, and child service agencies are more and more frequently recommending that couples try to mediate their issues. Levitt says a good mediator can help people get down to business.
Creating an atmosphere where both people are listening to one another in ways that they've perhaps never listened before, not rebutting the other person's attempt to explain their position within just a few seconds of what they're saying. A good mediator will help people learn to listen and effectively listen and effectively articulate in a way that both are speaking a language that they understand.
Getting there means wading through the emotional chaos. Judy Modest-Dixon is a Colorado-based mediator who says we shy away from conflict, not realizing that it can be a valuable tool.
If people are in conflict, then we really have an opportunity to look at what's most important to them. And I think that that's one of the things that a mediator has to do before we start looking at solutions. So it's not about making it all better. It's about understanding it for what it is.
The mediator's job is to focus, to keep people in the negotiation, thinking progressively toward resolution. Attorney Skip Cook, whose firm recommends the process to divorcing couples, says a mediator may have to take charge.
So sometimes there's a few rough moments in mediation until the mediator sort of, sizes up what the mediator's up against and takes, control and says, if we're going to get anywhere, we got to stop this kind of stuff, or we got to concentrate on this, or here's what, really is the issue.
But there's a difference between sorting wheat from chaff and pushing a solution. Levitt says parents have fairly common complaints when they've run into bad mediation.
That person tried really to advocate so-and-so's position, or that person really put in their own biases or their own ideas, or that person really began counseling us or giving us advice.
None of which works. Solutions have to come from the parents about custody, visitation, how to manage finances, and the future once the household is separated. Former attorney and Fairbanks mediator Michael Hostina says, tough as it is to make, a homemade agreement is good insurance.
The parties can construct their own solutions and reach a voluntary agreement that might also be better adhered to later because they've reached it themselves. They have ownership of it.
Barry Levitt.
Crisis, by definition, is a time of chaos, of disorder, a time when you're not asking people, regardless of the circumstances, to make major changes, major decisions about their lives, but rather you put some structure around them.
Something to reorganize with, he says. A tool to help two people calm down, look at the situation they're in, and find some remedies. In Fairbanks, I'm Susan McInnes.
Three, two, one. Blue Cross covers roughly 100,000 Alaskans. Recently, company auditors noticed they were paying for therapeutic massage, even though many of its health plans excluded the reimbursements. So the company notified chiropractors across the state that the company wanted the money back, an edict that wasn't well received. Spokesman Jeff Rowe says after talking it over with the doctors, the company backed off.
Blue Cross has decided to withdraw its request for a refund from chiropractors for services billed concerning massage therapy. And in the instead will cover the cost of the massage therapy and have clarified our policy concerning massage therapy.
Rose says under the old policy, the therapy wasn't permitted unless performed by the doctor. That confused chiropractors who believed their staff therapists were best qualified to provide massage. The new policy clarifies that doctors need only supervise the therapist to coordinate care. Some doctors directed their patients to contact Mike Humphrey, director of benefits at the University of Alaska. He says he's pleased the issue appears resolved, but he's disappointed that Blue Cross didn't first speak with the chiropractors before rebilling them.
It's unfortunate that when Blue Cross identified this issue, that they didn't take one step back and involve all those parties involved with the discussion of how massage therapy related in the chiropractic industry and its implications on the treatment patterns.
Humphrey says some patients get better results when they combine spinal adjustments with massage, and in this case, a little more communication could have avoided a lot of irritation. Blue Cross says its policy was targeted at six doctors who filed roughly 300 claims, and Roe agrees the situation could have been handled better. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
A month ago, bakery owner Mark Wumkes got a letter from the Disability Law Center of Alaska. It threatened to sue him unless he installed a wheelchair ramp. Wumkes says the heavy-handed letter was unnecessary, especially since he was already discussing his plans for a ramp with the Fairbanks Building Department.
In our case, they picked a business that we've been cooperative in all the compliance issues all along, and you can ask the people that were required to work with if that's true or not. And we want to comply. We feel this is a good law. People with disabilities have the right to access.
Wumke's Bakery falls into the same category with other Fairbanks business owners. Many older buildings weren't designed for a ramped entrance. The ADA recognizes that building a permanent ramp may not be simple, so business owners can pursue creative solutions like adding a portable ramp or offering mobile service. The ADA also exempts compliance if it costs too much. But the federal legislation doesn't name any agency responsible for enforcement, which frustrates both business owners and disabled people. Enforcement only happens when disabled people complain to business owners. If that fails, they may end up in court. Alaskan Jesse Owens, a paraplegic for 19 years, says this can be an unpleasant burden.
I filed one suit some years ago, and I realized that I got one ramp put in with a huge amount of effort and expense. There needed to be a better approach, which was more systematic, wasn't hostile in nature, and didn't depend on some kind of confrontation between a disabled person and a business.
That's where the Disability Law Center comes in. Janelle Wright says at Owen's prompting, the center started a campaign to get wheelchair ramps installed across the state. She says during an initial round of letters, they found businesses didn't respond until they were threatened. Wumke's letter was one of 270 mailed out as part of the campaign's second round.
A lot of businesses have responded, thank you so much for bringing this to our attention. We're going to build a ramp. How do we get a sign for designated parking? You know, a lot of businesses have really gotten into it and decided, okay, if we're going to do it, we're going to do it right, which is very encouraging. And, you know, we regret the fact that some businesses are upset about this, but we have to remember our client who's upset because he can't get into these businesses because they're not complying with the law.
Wright insists that the Disability Law Center is not fishing for cases with this campaign. It's just trying to make Alaska accessible. And she says the response to the second phase of the campaign has been good, with 10 new ramps built and 10 more already promised. Wumke says he's received city approval for his ramp plan and will begin construction this summer. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
While most kids are out chasing a job or on vacation this summer, others are back in school. The Summer Fine Arts Camp is just now gearing up. It's a month-long experience where the entire day is devoted to different aspects of art. Possible choices include theater, music, dance, and writing. And students mix and match classes to their preference. And some spend the entire day acting, while others might just dance. It all depends on what you like to do. There's plenty of socializing, though, and Allison Trivett says she really likes the people she meets at camp.
Since this is fine arts camp, I think people here tend to be a lot more creative, and there's like a lot of creative people in one concentrated area, so it's easier to relate to people who are more like me and who are into the same things that I am into, instead of like in another place like school, for example, where there's just a lot of different groups, which is nice too, but this way I can meet people with the same interests.
Trivett says former campers tipped her off about the people, and that was a deciding factor in her decision to attend. And the merits of the program itself are fantastic. Danielle Delaney enjoys the camp for its writing program because writing at camp is more rewarding than it is at school.
It's not for class. You don't get graded on it. They critique you, but it's what your work is. They're not expecting a certain level. They're not expecting just one thing. It's whatever comes out of your own mind. They may give you some ideas to make it work better.
Delaney says in school, essays and compositions take primary importance, while creative writing, like poetry, is seen as fluff. Yet those forms are important to her. While school provides a concrete education, offering limited artistic schooling, some kids desire a more balanced education and are motivated to attend school in the summer, devoting their free time to class once again. While kids enjoy the camp, instructors benefit too. Drama teacher Bernie Cheen.
I think it is a great opportunity for young people. I think it's very well handled, that the people who run the camp have a lot of concern for the young people who come here, have a lot of belief in what they do and the value of that to the young people who come here. It's a real opportunity for those who have had no exposure to the arts to get a taste of how wonderful they are and what it can mean to them in their lives. And for those who have had that exposure, it's a way to develop their talents with people that they probably wouldn't get a chance to study with otherwise.
The camp attracts students and teachers from across the nation, and with them, chances to expose each other to different views. They also get an opportunity to perform. Throughout the camp, students are presenting their talents in concerts, recitals, and plays, most of which are free and open to the public. In Fairbanks, I'm Justin Hargesheimer.
Fairbanks School Superintendent Percy Haltz says 400 employees in his district are eligible to join the Retirement Incentive Program this year, but the district won't participate because it would end up spending about $37,000 per employee. He says the district and the teachers' union have agreed to a plan of their own.
Our plan consists of offering teachers the incentive at $10,000. Under the state system, the teachers would have to pay approximately, high-end teachers would pay approximately $16,000 of their own money to pay in their share, and we would be paying in $37,000 per teacher as an average for our portion of it. And by giving them $10,000, it saves us $27,000, and it saves the teacher $16,000, and we figure it's a much better incentive.
Hout says 30 teachers will retire this year under the Fairbanks District's plan. The Retirement Incentive Program offers vested employees the option of buying years of service or age to qualify. If teachers work for 17 years, they could retire as a 20-year employee, although they would only receive benefits based on their actual years of service. Teachers who have worked more than 20 years will end up with benefits based on their actual time plus 3 years. State Retirement Supervisor Bill Church says before teachers can participate in the state's program, their district must prove to the Division of Retirement and Benefits that it will save money.
They can examine the cost savings over a 5-year period under the bill. That's what's allowed. And they have to look at, well, what is employee X going to cost me for the next 5 years? And if I rehire someone to replace them, what is it going to cost me as the employer to replace that person? And then it's a simple arithmetic calculation after that.
Nenana Superintendent John Gill says 6 or 7 of his employees are eligible for the retirement program, but he's not sure the district can afford it.
All the districts will be able to let or be able to evaluate their position as far as finances are concerned, and there's no way the smaller districts are going to be able to pay the employer portion for a lot of people at the same time.
The retirement incentive program will be available through August of 1997. To participate, district school boards must justify the savings by next July. Church says some districts are preparing now so their employees can retire this year. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher. Galena resident Kate Thurman went to Ruby Thursday night with a boatload of friends and family. There are strong family ties between the two communities, separated by only 50 miles of river. After visiting for several hours, Thurman and her brother-in-law left for Galena late that night. People in Ruby asked them to stop at fish camps along the way to let people know what had happened. Thurman says they stopped at Sydney and Angela Huntington's camp on Dainty Island first, then checked in with Laura Pitka.
I went and knocked on the cabin door and told Laura, "This is Kate. I need to talk to you." And so she woke up and let me come in, and I was sitting by her bed holding her hand, and I was telling her about what had happened up in Ruby and what happened to Aggie, and how there had been a possible murder that night, and that they need to be aware that someone could be on the river suspicious of anybody that they didn't know.
Thurman says tensions are high in Galena and the other river communities, where people are used to leaving their doors unlocked and welcoming strangers into their homes.
And people along the river are usually really friendly. You know, in boats, you're always waving to each other. We kind of know who's boat belongs to who, or what town it's from, or you know, something like that. But I think, you know, that night people were just really worried. We didn't know what had happened, really, you know, yet, and we just wanted to make sure that all avenues were looked at, so that whoever did this couldn't go and keep doing it, you know, couldn't keep killing other unsuspected people. So we just wanted to make sure that the people that were on the river, that they kind of knew something was going on, because they don't have a CB radio or a VHF radio.
Sergeant Jim McCann is supervising the case out of the Ruby School. He says detectives are following a two-pronged investigation.
I think everybody knows about the witness testimony about different strangers being seen in town on the day of Aggie's murder. Certainly we're trying to identify those people. It doesn't mean they're suspects in this crime. You know, there's people coming and going from these villages all the time for different reasons. And we're just trying to locate all these different people and eliminate them as suspects. And we're also talking to all the townsfolk and trying to identify any possible suspects here in town.
McCann says his team would like to stay in Ruby until the case is solved. He says a limited search for possible suspects by boat and air continues, although funding is stretched. So far, no clues have been found. Many people from Galena and other river villages will travel to Ruby later this week for Wright's funeral. Thurman says it's a common way for friends and neighbors to show their support and respect for the family. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
If the mountaineers, climbers, and other thrill-seekers show up at the airport Friday afternoon, they won't find pilots anxious to take them into the open, sunny skies. Instead, visitors will be in for a different kind of pace, with a couple hundred Talkeetnans in and around the Talkeetna Aero Services hangar. Business owner Eric Dankewalter is hosting the fifth annual event.
A couple local bands and maybe even a Dixieland band this year will be something different. Have about four kegs of beer and I don't know how many cases of soda. Usually have moose meat, and we have some regular hamburgers and hot dogs. We've got some bear meat this year that we're going to barbecue. The kids all come and play on that big sand pile behind us there. And so the parents usually drag them home around 10:30 or so. They're completely filthy, but they have a wonderful time too.
Dankewalter says with all the light, people hang out all night, listening to the music and having fun, provided the weather holds.
Of course, we want a nice day because the airplanes that are coming back from the glacier, the Ken, will bring back a garbage bag full of snow, and then we cool down the beer and all the soda with that, so it works out pretty well. We don't really want too much excitement at the party. We have enough excitement during the day normally. This year we're hoping to get a guy to come down with what's called a pogo jet, which is a parachute that it inflates, and you got a propeller on your back, and he can kind of take off running.
Interesting. Well, it goes on all day, so.
There's a wide spectrum of solstice celebrations in Talkeetna, but the airport has by far the largest, loudest, and most regular one. In Talkeetna, I'm Kai Plaskon.
Athabascan Jackie Esai knows the obstacles facing Native students in Bush, Alaska's tiny schools. She grew up in the isolated western interior village of Nikolai, population 50, where imported, mostly well-meaning teachers can face cultural barriers.
In villages, some people tend to underestimate the students and think that they're not capable of, you know, a lot of things, and that I think that they kind of, I don't know, are a little bit patronizing to them, and they don't challenge them enough. I think, too, it might be part of the cultural accents. When someone doesn't speak clearly, it's harder to understand them, and you assume that they don't understand you as well, I think.
After the eighth grade, inspired by a teacher who broke that mold, Esai went looking for more. She spent her freshman year at a larger school in the nearby village of McGrath. Then, like many Native villagers before her, Esai left the bush to attend the state's Mount Edgecombe boarding school in faraway Sitka in southeast Alaska. Now graduated, she's poised for a rare university education at a prestigious private Lower 48 institution. Esai is one of two recipients this year granted an American Indian scholarship from the University of Denver in Colorado, an award worth well over $100,000. Esai speaks with confidence about her bright future, but doesn't take all the credit for her success.
I wanted my family to be proud of me, and they were always a big motivation for me. I think my mom helped me a lot. She placed lots of emphasis on education, and she always encouraged me to read.
Esai says she'll approach college with an open perspective and has no immediate plans for a major. Her interests are eclectic and include everything from Athabascan dance to engineering and Japanese, a language she'll continue to study in Denver. Esai's vision and drive are beyond her years, something which didn't go unnoticed by University of Denver admissions. Marie Mendoza of UDC's Minority Affairs Office was part of the scholarship selection team.
She just seemed to be a very mature person, for one thing, very connected to her people, and very bright and very motivated. And just I think the strength of her sense of self-identity overall was really outstanding. And 18-year-olds don't usually have the kind of vision that she demonstrates, a world vision, I guess, in a sense, beyond herself, and kind of a more of a global look at life.
Mendoza will be mentoring Esai when she leaves her home in Nikolai to begin school at the University of Denver in September. In McGrath, I'm Dan Bross.
The Goat Trail winds along the north wall of Keystone Canyon, several hundred feet above the low river. The Richardson Highway followed the same route until it moved down to the river in the late 1940s. 76-year-old Bob Kelsey of Valdez says the road was wide enough for one vehicle and collisions were common. He remembers driving with his mother in a 1927 Studebaker and meeting a car going the other way.
There's no way that you could get around each other, and the brakes on those cars in those days were not very good. So we had a collision right on that Poison Point. That was the name of the point. It was hewed out of solid rock for the road to go around there.
Motorized traffic is no longer an obstacle. Now the problem is thick alder, but volunteers armed with a chainsaw, weed cutter, and other tools will widen and clear the trail. Michael Schwicht of Valdez, with help from the City Parks and Recreation Department, is leading the effort and hopes to become an Eagle Scout by demonstrating leadership and planning skills. He says it will be another activity for local residents and tourists to enjoy.
I wouldn't say that it's going to boost the business for fuel for tourists, but it's definitely going to add something for the tourists that they can remember.
The trail offers spectacular views of the river and waterfalls in Keystone Canyon. Two Californians who tried to walk the trail last summer were so taken by what they saw, they're back in Valdez this summer to help clear it. Dave Schwartz, who works on trails as a retirement project, says he and his wife like the community and want to contribute to it.
Our satisfaction will be that if it gets done, which I'm sure it will, and it's maintained enough to keep it in in use, then that'll make the trip worthwhile. We'll feel good about it. We'll come back again and hike it.
For Schwartz's wife, Katrina Smathers, the project is a sort of homecoming. She graduated from Fairbanks High School and attended the university there.
I've always hoped to get to do a community project in Alaska, so I'm very happy to have this one. And very much a believer in both in governmental and private organizations and volunteers working together, and this is just an excellent example of that.
Smathers, Schwartz, and the other volunteers will be clearing the trail through Saturday, June 29th. In Valdez, I'm Greg Williams.
They're making good progress on that fire. It's currently at about 7,500 acres, but most of the increased acreage was due to the burnout operation. The winds shifting to the south and becoming much lighter and a higher relative humidity has really helped efforts on that fire. It's about 40% contained now. No estimate on when complete containment will be, but things look hopeful.
When you drop a bomb from a plane, the plane, it's like a good example would be taking a couple passengers out of a car. You know, you're going to feel the difference, and for a pilot to be able to actually perform that maneuver in combat, what we're trying to do is to get them used to the feel of the aircraft, you know, when it's dropping the bombs, so that it becomes more of a second nature.
It was necessary to consult with the Russian embassy in Washington. It was necessary to consult with Central Electoral Commission in Moscow. And I was told that my letter was delivered to the Central Electoral Commission in Moscow and to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And the decision was taken in Moscow to permit all the Russians who stay in Fairbanks to vote.
It's important. It's very important, but you see 20 or 100 or 1,000 or 1 million, every Russian citizen, according to the Constitution, has the right to vote. And that's why the Council decided to spend. Of course, we spent a lot of money. Our citizens here will vote together with the citizens in the Far East.
State epidemiologist Beth Funk says public health nurses have been following up. They're administering skin tests to anyone who may have been infected in area villages. No new cases have been diagnosed from these follow-ups. Funk says it takes a great deal of exposure to contract tuberculosis, which causes fluid to build up in the lungs.
If you're just with the person for a few minutes or for a day or an evening, then that's not really a risk. It's an ongoing kind of thing over a period of weeks and months that would put a person at possible risk for becoming infected.
Once a person has been infected, the disease can lie dormant in the lungs and flare up into active TB later. Early knowledge of TB exposure lets a person with a positive skin test take a drug to decrease the chance of developing active TB by 90%. And Funk says early treatment of active TB helps to minimize the effects of the disease.
The sooner that a person with active disease is diagnosed and started on usually four drugs, four anti-tuberculosis drugs are needed for disease, the sooner the better, because the person doesn't get as sick and they start feeling better a lot more quickly.
During the 1940s and 50s, TB was epidemic among Alaska Natives, infecting entire villages. Many Alaskans now have positive skin tests and should be aware of the symptoms for active TB, including a productive cough lasting several weeks, night sweats and fever, and loss of appetite or weight loss. Someone with these symptoms should see a doctor as soon as possible. These days, 50 to 90 new cases of TB are reported annually across Alaska, a rate shared by the rest of the states. and it's unusual for TB to be fatal with the medicines now available. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
You're young, out of school, and you need money. So what do? You're young, out of school, and you need money. So what do? That's right, get a job. After days of searching, you finally snag an opening at a local hotel, catering to tourists. Just like dishbusser Natalie Neubauer, who paints a rather ugly picture of her job.
You have to do everything as a busser, because on your little sheet, when it has the descriptions of the busser, it says you control nobody. And so basically, you're the person that everybody shits on, and it's like they need a garbage can cleaned, you clean it. Even the maids come up and are like, yeah, I need help down here, da-da-da-da-da. And they're like bitching at you, right? And you're like, all right, whatever. And you just get all this crap thrown on you all the time. And if you ever just want to sit down for 5 seconds, the manager comes in at that point and is like, oh, we got some garbage cans out in the front here that need to be cleaned and washed and scrubbed and bathed in and da-da-da and all this crap. And so that's what I do every day.
Ah, the summer job, an inevitable part of adolescence. It's all about low wages, bad hours, and all-around uncoolness. Most kids, once school's out, have absolutely no plans on what to do with all that free time. Money can occupy your time pretty well, but wallets never seem to stay full enough. Plus, for many, college is on the horizon and mom and dad can't always foot the bill. The solution? J-O-B. There's tons of possibilities, even for those with no experience. There's always McTaco Hut. But food service jobs, especially fast food, well, they're just lame. Graham Wilson says stuffing Happy Meals rates pretty near the bottom and prefers his work at a local bakery.
You can be monotone about it. I mean, you work in a McDonald's, you say, give me my hamburger, beep, 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 they toss you the burger, no more about it, you know? But at Babs, you know, people, you know, they look at the bread, they ask questions about it, I mean, kind of discuss them. There's a lot of casual conversation and, you know, it's just kind of, it's a nicer atmosphere. And you got to actually work on that, even if you're in a bad mood or something like that. You gotta have a smile on your face.
And keeping that smile on your face is actually a benefit disguised as a demand. Aside from making money, the summer job creates valuable job experience that will come in handy later on. Nina Tartikoff, a guidance counselor at Lathrop High School, says that there are many hidden benefits of getting a job, just one of which is interacting with unfamiliar people.
Anytime you're working with people, you're gaining skills, any of the different equipment or types of things that you have to do at any job are skills that are going to carry over in any job that you have later on. So I think all of those are valuable.
Tartikoff also says the summer job is almost an extension of school, a real-life classroom that's preparation for the future. Yet like real life, this classroom can be unfair. Maren Wiebold, a high school waitress, says she learned a lesson about workplace discrimination when an older coworker didn't respect her because she was young.
A couple months ago, a cook just bothered me. He wouldn't do anything I asked him to do, which put me behind with my work schedule, and the customers were not satisfied, and that bothered my boss, Joan, and it was not good for the business.
Wiebold says the cook was later fired. But age discrimination isn't a widespread problem for teens. For kids working a summer job, monotony and grease burns pose a bigger challenge. Makes school look pretty good, eh? In Fairbanks, I'm Justin Hargesheimer.
Anchorage-based Quality Asphalt Paving bid almost $11 million to rebuild the first 7 miles of the Chena Hot Springs Road. But owner Gordon Hayes says early on, confusion mounted over the existence of various phone and electric lines. although he wouldn't talk on tape. Hayes says DOT wanted him to delay construction until July, when utilities could be moved. But Hayes says he wanted to start work on another segment to keep his employees busy. Regional Director Tony Johansson says DOT and Quality received conflicting information regarding the existence of the utility lines. Quality insisted they be moved. DOT argued they weren't in the way. The confusion resulted in DOT's terminating the contract, and Johansson says by the time the state figured out the utilities were not a problem, Quality decided not to return to the job.
We found that, in fact, the utility conflicts in that section were minor enough that the contractor could go to work in that area. And that's the crux of our problem, is trying to understand why we end up with the information we ended up with regarding the existence or the non-existence of utilities within our excavation.
Johansson continues working to find out what went wrong and how to ensure it doesn't happen again. Meanwhile, the job will be out to bid once more.
We will go back to bid this year, yet whether or not we'll be going back to bid in time to do any meaningful work, I don't know. In any event, beginning the 8th of July, we'll have maintenance forces out there getting the road in shape for traveling public, and we'll maintain it at an acceptable level.
In spite of coming in more than $1 million under the next highest bid, Hayes plans to be back as well. He says he bought a 120-acre gravel pit, and he'd like to see it working. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter. Three, two, one. In 1980, Congress required states to form groups for disposing of low-level radioactive waste like contaminated clothing and scientific instruments. Alaska and seven other states send waste to Hanford, Washington. This year, the state spent close to $10,000 for radiation program manager Doug Dasher to represent the state before the group and handle other radiation issues. The legislature cut the funding, but without the program, Dasher says scientists at oil and mining companies, hospitals, engineering firms, and other waste generators will be in a bind.
It also creates a situation where generators in the state would not be able to ship from Alaska to the disposal site in the state of Washington. And basically, other than the site at Barnwell, South Carolina, which may close, and it's also much more costly, they would not have a facility to ship low-level waste, and they would have to store it in-state until we developed a disposal site.
If landfill construction is any example, building a low-level nuclear waste dump will be expensive. But companies and agencies that use radioactive isotopes are required to maintain waste disposal plans. Susan Henricks, radiation safety officer at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, says they must show where the waste will go.
It does create a big problem for me. I now don't, potentially wouldn't have a place to dispose of the low-level waste generated by the university. And also, I'm going to need to spend a fair amount of time and effort figuring out how to solve this problem.
In terms of volume, Alaska exports little low-level radioactive waste. Dasher says it amounts to about 2 drums a year. Producers pay the disposal fees and indirectly part of Dasher's expenses. DEC is exploring alternatives to pay for the program, and Dasher says he's looking at imposing fees to make up the difference. But first, the legislature must earmark the fees to pay for the program, and Dasher says it'll cost more money than the state currently spends.
A fee-based structure would require, of course, to implement with the administrative services and add those personnel time to charge, collect fees, account for the fees. So the cost for running a fee-based program would probably be in the range of $10,000 to $15,000 a year.
With only 30 or 40 waste generators statewide, the fees might be substantial. Dasher says he's taking the first steps to figure out how to fairly impose the charge among users. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
2. Cut the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation sewage management budget by $185,000, so the DEC says it will no longer review subdivision plans for developers across the state. DEC manager Paul Pinard says the burden of assessing issues of public health in subdivisions will now sit on the shoulders of local governments.
It certainly is going to be dependent upon whether or not local governments, and in this case the Matsu Borough, picks up our criteria dealing with the suitability of lots in new subdivisions for wastewater disposal and does the same type of review that we do.
Until local governments take on the program, local residents will have to bear the responsibility to ensure sewer systems are properly installed to avoid water contamination and other hazards. Pinard says Talkeetna is one community that has seen unregulated development before.
The small lots and the shallow groundwater conditions meant that there certainly was problems with on-lot wastewater disposal. And because of those problems and contamination of water supply, that's why you saw the community water and sewer systems go in for Talkeetna.
This week, borough planners have started working on ideas to develop the new subdivision and wastewater disposal programs. Assistant borough planner Rick Brown says they will be accepting public comment through July in order to set up a plan that the borough can work with.
I believe the word is pretty well out to the real estate community, to the lenders, and to a number of other people. All right, we're going to need their input to get an idea as to which direction they would like us to head.
In Valdez, there has never been DEC supervision of sewage management. Assistant City Manager, Director of Community Development, Dave Dengel, has some advice for the Mat-Su Borough.
If they'd have to adopt some ordinances that, you know, dictate separations from septic systems and wells and streams and property lines and things like that, if the people don't want more regulation, there's going to be a problem. You're going to have to do something. I mean, if the state's not going to do it, someone's going to have to do it to oversee that, to make sure that subdivisions are constructed in such a fashion or in such an area that allow for outside sewer and water. Otherwise, you're going to have a mess. And because the soils don't change as much down here as they do probably up in the Mat-Su, where it's a lot bigger area.
Borough planning officials say in the past the DEC has done a good job with assessment. Mat-Su Planning Director John Duffy said the process of assessment used to take 2 months, but may now take 6 months for the 33 plats that are awaiting subdivision in Willow, Talkeetna, and Petersville. In Talkeetna, I'm Kai Plaskon.
Bruce Lee has worked in Denali National Park for 20 years. He loves his present job as a bus tour driver, traveling the notorious road to Wonder Lake. He and the other 125 drivers are a close-knit group. They hang out, play music, eat pizza, and even kayak together.
There is a real sense of community spirit, and I guess that is probably the bottom line of why this happened, because unlike in other jobs where if something happens to an employee, they just disappear, this group of people are friends, and we care about each other. And I will say, through a minor decision from the company this year, three of our community aren't working there this year. And that began to scare the drivers.
2 years ago, the National Park Service awarded the shuttle bus contract to Aramark. Since then, the company's made several changes. The company cut driver wages and laid down rules for employee appearance and grooming. The drivers wanted a say in these and other issues, like safety and job security. So Lee says at the suggestion of local Aramark managers, they organized the Denali National Park Drivers Association.
What we found out was that we really didn't have a paid staff. This took a tremendous amount of time. We did not have the legal expertise and the labor background to keep them at the table in good faith to address a lot of these issues. So what they told us at the end of that session, that we should get more organized, and over the winter the drivers did that, and they found out that there was a way to enter into an affiliation, keeping our own autonomy, but in association with the Teamsters.
But Aramark hotel manager Steve Halloran says the bus drivers don't need a union because the company maintains an open-door policy.
We have dealt with folks, you know, and prefer to deal with folks on a one-to-one basis, and that seems to have been, you know, reasonably successful on both ends. The drivers have enjoyed pretty good, I guess we consider them pretty good working conditions and reasonable wages, you know, given the nature of the job.
The drivers approached the Teamsters Union earlier this year and started exploring an affiliation with the labor specialists. Teamster spokesman Steve Saplocha says the local 959 has entered into 4 or 5 of these arrangements where they represent another, smaller union.
In collective bargaining, it is important to have solid
professional representation, and it is solid. You need professional negotiators, you need professional legal assistance, and as you can see, a unit such as the bus drivers of 100 or 120 people, where would they get the money to hire a negotiator, a union representative, and a lawyer?
The Denali bus drivers will pay dues based on income for the representation they get from Local 959. Lee says an overwhelming majority of the drivers wanted this affiliation, although he could not say exactly how many signed the petition. These days, bus drivers start at $9.50 an hour, and Halloran says the pay scale increases to about $18, depending on how many years a driver's been working. Saplocha says the Teamsters have already contacted Aramark to set up their first collective bargaining meeting. In Fairbanks, I'm Teresa Bacher.
From the namesake mastodon tusk hanging above its entryway, to the manicured lawn outside and the plush carpeting, leather furniture, and big screen TV adorning its interior, McGrath's Tekusko House Lodge is out of place amongst the more functional decor of rural Alaska. For almost 10 years, retired Bush schoolteacher Tom Sheets developed the Tekusko House from what was originally a conspicuous family home to a luxurious outpost for travelers weary of the mosquitoes, dust, snow, and 50 below the interior can unleash.
It's gotten to be a pretty nice establishment at this point, and it's time for me to move on. I've been in McGrath for 20 years and really enjoyed it, but there's lots of potentials here that I think have yet to be developed.
Hoping to make good on the Tekusko House's $750,000 potential are new owners Buck and Sharina Griffith. The Griffiths bring the kind of experience which should complement the Tekusko House's mission.
Sharina and I came from a little town in Stehekin, Washington. It's smaller than McGrath. It's got 50 people in it. It's totally isolated, boat, plane only. We were running a large lodge there, and Shereen has been a head chef at a very nice restaurant.
I've been cooking almost 17 years, and if you see Bucky, you could tell.
The Griffiths say they hope to continue the Tekusko House tradition of homey luxury and good food established by former owner Sheets, including the buildup of his most recent brainchild, Bush Tours. The idea pairs local guides with tourists to explore the upper Kuskokwim Valley backcountry by the likes of snow machine, dog sled, raft, and mountain bike. There's plenty of other potential as well, including plans to offer walk-in meals and takeout pizza, but buying the Tekusko House is as much a lifestyle choice as an investment for the Griffiths.
We like working for ourselves. We've been self-employed most of our lives. And so we started looking about a year ago, and we picked this one because it fits our needs.
Those needs include a school for the couple's 7-year-old son, city water, sewer, and electricity, and friendly townspeople. The Griffiths' arrival sees the McGrath departure of not only Tekusko House founder Sheets, but manager and chef Twan Dean. Dean is headed for Galena, where he'll be breaking new ground by opening what will probably be the Yukon's first restaurant specializing in international buffet-style dining. For his part, Sheets is happy to have no plans at present, but says he'll be back at the Tekusko House this winter to help out during the Iron Dog snow machine race and the Iditarod. In McGrath, I'm Dan Bross.